By chance, I ran into a nurse from your hospital earlier today. My first encounter with her was one which, for various reasons, I was anxious to terminate abruptly. It was only while I was standing on the pavement a minute or two later, fending off the local wildlife, that one of the words I had heard her say struck me, I may say somewhat like a thunderbolt. The idea was fantastically, wildly improbable, but like most fantastically, wildly improbable ideas, it was at least as worthy of consideration as a more mundane one to which the facts had been strenuously bent to fit. I returned to question her further, and she confirmed that a somewhat unusual patient had, in the early hours of the morning, been transferred from the hospital, apparently to the Woodshead. She also confided to me that another patient had been almost indecently curious to find out what had become of him. That patient was a Miss Kate Schechter, and I think you will agree, Miss Schechter, that my methods of navigation have their advantages. I may not have gone where I intended to go, but I think I have ended up where I needed to be. After about half an hour, a hefty man from the local garage arrived, with a pickup truck, a tow rope, and a son. Having looked at the situation, he sent his son and the pickup truck away to deal with another job, attached the tow rope to Kate's now-defunct car, and pulled it away to the garage himself. Kate was a little quiet about this for a minute or two, and then said, "He wouldn't have done that if I hadn't been an American." He had recommended to them a small local pub, where he would come and look for them when he had made his diagnosis on the Citroen. Since Dirk's Jaguar had only lost its front right indicator light, and Dirk insisted that he hardly ever turned right anyway, they drove the short distance there. As Kate, with some reluctance, climbed into Dirk's car, she found the Howard Bell book, which Dirk had purloined from Sally Mills in the cafe, and pounced on it. A few minutes later, walking into the pub, she was still trying to work out if it was one she had read or not. The pub combined all the traditional English qualities of horse brasses, formica, and surliness. The sound of Michael Jackson in the other bar mingled with the mournful intermittence of the glass-cleaning machine in this one, to create an oral ambience which perfectly matched the elderly paintwork in its dinginess. Dirk bought himself and Kate a drink each, and then joined her at the small corner table she had found away from the fat, T-shirted hostility of the bar. "I have read it," she announced, having thumbed her way by now through most of Run Like the Devil. "At least I started it and read the first couple of chapters, a couple of months ago, in fact. I don't know why I still read his books. It's perfectly clear that his editor doesn't." She looked up at Dirk. "I wouldn't have thought it was your sort of thing, from what little I know of you." "It isn't," said Dirk. I picked it up by mistake." "That's what everyone says," replied Kate. "He used to be quite good," she added, "if you like that sort of thing. My brother's in publishing in New York, and he says that Howard Bell's gone very strange nowadays. I get the feeling they're all a little afraid of him, and he quite likes that. Certainly no one seems to have the guts to tell him he should cut chapters 10 to 27 inclusive, and all the stuff about the goat. The theory is that the reason he sells so many millions of copies is that nobody ever does read them. If everyone who bought them actually read them, they'd never bother to buy the next one, and his career would be over." She pushed it away from her. "Anyway," she said, "you very cleverly told me why I went to the Woodshead. You haven't told me why you were going there yourself." Dirk shrugged. "To see what it was like," he said noncommittally. "Oh yes? Well, I'll save you the bother. The place is quite horrible. Describe it. In fact, start with the airport." Kate took a hefty swig at her Bloody Mary, and brooded silently for a moment while the vodka marched around inside her. "You want to hear about the airport as well?" she said at last. "Yes." Kate drained the rest of her drink. "I'll need another one then," she said, and pushed the empty glass across at him. Dirk braved the bug-eyedness of the barman, and returned a minute or two later with a refill for Kate. "Okay," said Kate, "I'll start with a cat." "What cat?" "The cat I needed to ask the next-door neighbour to look after for me." "Which next-door neighbour?" "The one that died." "I see," said Dirk. "Tell you what, why don't I just shut up and let you tell me?" "Yes," said Kate, "that would be good." Kate recounted the events of the last few days, or at least those she was conscious for, and then moved on to her impressions of the Woodshead. Despite the distaste with which she described it, it sounded to Dirk like exactly the sort of place he would love to retire to, if possible, tomorrow. It combined a dedication to the inexplicable, which was his own persistent vice, which he could only think of such, and sometimes rail against it with the fury of an addict, with a pampered self-indulgence which was a vice to which he would love to be able to aspire, if he could ever but afford it. At last Kate related her disturbing encounter with Mr. Odwin and his repellent minion, and it was as a result of this that Dirk remained sunk in a frowning silence for a minute afterwards. A large part of this minute was in fact taken up with an internal struggle about whether or not he was going to cave in and have a cigarette. He had recently forsworn them, and the struggle was a regular one, and he lost it regularly, often without noticing. He decided with triumph that he would not have one, and then took one out anyway. Fishing out his lighter from the capacious pocket of his coat involved first taking out the envelope he had removed from Geoffrey Anstey's bathroom. He put it on the table next to the book, and lit his cigarette. "The check-in girl at the airport," he he said at last. She drove me mad, said Kate instantly. She just went through the motions of doing her job like some kind of blank machine. Wouldn't listen, wouldn't think. I don't know where they find people like that. She used to be my secretary, in fact, said Dirk. They don't seem to know where to find her now, either. Oh, I'm sorry, said Kate immediately, and then reflected for a moment. I expect you're going to say that she wasn't like that, really, she continued. Well, that's possible. I expect she was just shielding herself from the frustrations of her job. It must drive you insensible working at an airport. I think I would have sympathized with her if I hadn't been so goddamn frustrated myself. I'm sorry, I didn't know. So that's what you're trying to find out about. Dirk gave a non-committal type of nod. Amongst other things, he said. Then he added, I'm a private detective. Oh, said Kate in surprise, and then looked puzzled. Does that bother you? It's just that I have a friend who plays the double bass. I see, said Dirk. Whenever people meet him and he's struggling around with it, they all say the same thing and it drives him crazy. They say, I bet you wished you played the piccolo. Nobody ever works out that that's what everybody else says. I was just trying to work out if there was something that everybody would always say to a private detective, so that I could avoid saying it. No. What happens is that everybody looks very shifty for a moment, and you got that very well. I see. Kate looked disappointed. Well, do you have any clues? That is to say, any idea about what's happened to your secretary? No, said Dirk. No idea. Just a vague image that I don't know what to make of. He toyed thoughtfully with his cigarette, and then let his gaze wander over the table again, and onto the book. He picked it up and looked it over, wondering what impulse had made him pick it up in the first place. I don't really know anything about Howard Bell, he said. Kate was surprised at the way he suddenly changed the subject, but also a little relieved. I only know, said Dirk, that he sells a lot of books, and they all look pretty much like this. What should I know? Well, there are some very strange stories about him. Like what? Like what he gets up to in hotel suites all across America. No one knows the details, of course. They just get the bills and pay them because they don't like to ask. They feel they're on safer ground if they don't know, particularly about the chickens. Chickens, said Dirk. What chickens? Well, apparently, said Kate, lowering her voice and leaning forward a little, he's always having live chickens delivered to his hotel room. Dirk frowned. What on earth for? He said. Nobody knows. Nobody ever knows what happens to them. Nobody ever sees them again. Not, she said, leaning even further forward and dropping her voice still further, a single feather. Dirk wondered if he was being hopelessly innocent and naive. So what do people think he's doing with them? He asked. Nobody, Kate said, has the faintest idea. They don't even want to have the faintest idea. They just don't know. She shrugged and picked the book up again herself. The other thing David, that's my brother, says about him is that he has the absolute perfect bestseller's name. Really, said Dirk? In what way? David says it's the first thing any publisher looks for in a new author. Not, is his stuff any good? Or, is his stuff any good once you get rid of all the adjectives? But, is his last name nice and short and his first name just a bit longer? You see, the Bell is done in huge silver letters, and the Howard fits neatly across the top in slightly narrower ones. Instant trademark. It's publishing magic. Once you've got a name like that, then whether you can actually write or not is a minor detail, which in Howard's Bell's case is now a significant bonus. But it's a very ordinary name if you write it down in the normal way, like it is here, you see. What? Said Dirk. Here, on this envelope of yours. Where? Let me see. That's his name, isn't it? There. Crossed out. Good heavens, you're right, said Dirk, peering at the envelope. I suppose I didn't recognize it without its trademark shape. Is this something to do with him, then? Said Kate, picking it up and looking it over. I don't know what it is exactly, said Dirk. It's something to do with a contract, and it may be something to do with a record. I can see how it might be to do with a record. How can you see that? Asked Dirk sharply. Well, this name here is Dennis Hutch, isn't it? See? Oh, yes. Yes, I do, said Dirk, examining it himself. Should I know that name? Well, said Kate slowly, it depends if you're alive or not, I suppose. He's the head of the Aries Rising Record Group. Less famous than the Pope, I grant you, but you know of the Pope, I take it. Yes, yes, said Dirk impatiently, white-haired chap. That's him. He seems to be about the only person of note this envelope hasn't been addressed to at some time. Here's Stan Dubček, the head of Dubček Danton Heidegger Draycott. I know they handle the ARG account. The what? ARG, Aries Rising Record Group Holdings. Getting that account made the agency's fortunes. She looked at Dirk. You have the air, she stated, of one who knows little of the record business or the advertising business. I have that honour, said Dirk, graciously inclining his head. So what are you doing with this? When I manage to get it open, I'll know, said Dirk. Do you have a knife on you? Kate shook her head. Who's Geoffrey Anstey, then? She asked. He's the only name not crossed out. Friend of yours? Dirk paled a little and didn't immediately answer. Then he said, This strange person you mentioned, this something nasty in the woods head creature, Tell me again what he said to you. He said, I too have the advantage of you, Miss Schechter. Kate tried to shrug. Dirk weighed his thoughts uncertainly for a moment. I think it is just possible, he said at last, that you may be in some kind of danger. You mean it's possible that passing lunatics may crash into me on the road? That kind of danger? Maybe even worse. Oh, yeah? Yes. And what makes you think that? It's not entirely clear to me yet, replied Dirk with a frown. Most of the ideas I have at the moment have to do with things that are completely impossible, so I am wary about sharing them. They are, however, the only thoughts I have. I'd get some different ones then, said Kate. What was the Sherlock Holmes principle? Once you have discounted the impossible, then whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. I reject that entirely, said Dirk sharply. The impossible often has a kind of integrity to it, which the merely improbable lacks. How often have you been presented with an apparently rational explanation of something which works in all respects other than one, which is just that it's hopelessly improbable? Your instinct is to say yes, but he or she simply wouldn't do that. Well, it happened to me today, in fact, replied Kate. Ah, yes, said Dirk, slapping the table and making the glasses jump. Your girl in the wheelchair, a perfect example. The idea that she is somehow receiving yesterday's stock market prices, apparently out of thin air, is merely impossible, and therefore must be the case, because the idea that she is maintaining an immensely complex and laborious hoax of no benefit to herself is hopelessly improbable. The first idea merely supposes that there is something we don't know about, and God knows there are enough of those. The second, however, runs contrary to something fundamental and human, which we do know about. We should therefore be very suspicious of it, and all its specious rationality. But you won't tell me what you think. No. Why not? Because it sounds ridiculous, but I think you are in danger. I think you might be in horrible danger. Great! So what do you suggest I do about it? Said Kate, taking a sip of her second drink, which otherwise had stayed almost untouched. I suggest, said Dirk seriously, that you come back to London and spend the night in my house. Kate hooted with laughter, and then had to fish out a Kleenex to wipe tomato juice off herself. I'm sorry, what's so extraordinary about that? Demanded Dirk, rather taken aback. It's just the most wonderfully perfunctory pick-up line I've ever heard. She smiled at him. I'm afraid the answer is a resounding no. He was, she thought, interesting, entertaining in an eccentric kind of way, but also hideously unattractive to her. Dirk felt very awkward. I think there's been some appalling misunderstanding, he said. Allow me to explain that... He was interrupted by the sudden arrival in their midst of the mechanic from the garage, with news of Kate's car. Fixed it, he said. In fact, there was nothing to fix other than the bumper. Nothing new, that is. The funny noise you mentioned was just the engine. But it'll go all right. You just have to rev her up, let in the clutch, and then wait for a little bit longer than you might normally expect. Kate thanked him a little stiffly for this advice, and then insisted on allowing Dirk to pay the £25 he was charging for it. Outside in the car park, Dirk repeated his urgent request that Kate should go with him, but she was adamant that all she needed was a good night's sleep, and that everything would look bright and clear and easily capable of being coped with in the morning. Dirk insisted that they should at least exchange phone numbers. Kate agreed to this, on condition that Dirk found another route back to London, and didn't sit on her tail. "Be very careful!" Dirk called out to her, as her car grumbled out onto the road. "I will!" shouted Kate. "And if anything impossible happens, I promise you'll be the first to know." For a brief moment, the yellow undulations of the car gleamed dully in the light leaking from the pub windows, and stood out against the heavily hunched greyness of the night sky, which soon swallowed it up. Dirk tried to follow her, but his car wouldn't start. The clouds sank more heavily over the land, clenching into huge sullen towers, as Dirk, in a sudden access of alarm, had to call out the man from the garage once again. He was slower to arrive with his truck this time, and bad-tempered with drink when at last he did. He emitted a few intemperate barks of laughter at Dirk's predicament, then fumbled the bonnet of his car open, and subjected him to all kinds of muttered talk about manifolds, pumps, alternators and starlings, and resolutely would not be drawn on whether or not he was going to be able to get the thing to go again that night. Dirk was unable to get a meaningful answer, or at least an answer that meant anything to him, as to what was causing the rumpus in the alternator, what ailed the fuel pump, in what way the operation of the starter motor was being disrupted, and why the timing was off. He did at last understand that the mechanic was also claiming that a family of starlings had at some time in the past made their nest in a sensitive part of the engine's workings, and had subsequently perished horribly, taking sensitive parts of the engine with them. And at this point, Dirk began to cast about himself desperately for what to do. He noticed that the mechanic's pickup truck was standing nearby, with its engine still running, and elected to make off with this instead. Being a slightly less slow and cumbersome runner than the mechanic, He was able to put this plan into operation with a minimum of difficulty. He swung out into the lane, drove off into the night, and parked 3 miles down the road. He left the van's lights on, let down its tires, and hid himself behind a tree. After about 10 minutes, his Jaguar came hurtling round the corner, past the van, hauled itself to an abrupt halt, and reversed wildly back towards it. The mechanic threw open the door, leapt out, and hurried over to reclaim his property, leaving Dirk with the opportunity he needed to leap from behind the tree and reclaim his own. He spun his wheels pointedly, and drove off in a kind of grim triumph, still haunted, nevertheless, by anxieties to which he was unable to give a name or shape. Kate, in the meantime, had joined the dimly glowing yellow stream that led on eventually through the western suburbs of Acton and Ealing, and into the heart of London. She crawled up over the Westway flyover, and soon afterwards turned north up towards Primrose Hill, and home. She always enjoyed driving up alongside the park, and the dark night shapes of the trees soothed her, and made her long for the quietness of her bed. She found the nearest parking space she could to her front door, which was about 30 yards distant. She climbed out of the car, and carefully omitted to lock it. She never left anything of value in it, and she found that it was to her advantage if people didn't have to break anything in order to find that out. The car had been stolen twice, but on each occasion it had been found abandoned 20 yards away. She didn't go straight home, but set off instead in the opposite direction to get some milk and bin liners from the small corner shop in the next street. She agreed with the gentle-faced Pakistani who ran it that she did indeed look tired, and should have an early night. But, on the way back, she made another small diversion, to go and lean against the railings of the park, gaze into its darkness for a few minutes, and breathe in some of its cold, heavy night air. At last she started to head back towards her flat. She turned into her own road, and as she passed the first street lamp, it flickered and went out, leaving her in a small pool of darkness. That sort of thing always gives one a nasty turn. It is said that there is nothing surprising about the notion of, for instance, a person suddenly thinking about someone they haven't thought about for years, and then discovering the next day that that person has in fact just died. There are always lots of people suddenly remembering people they haven't thought about for ages, and always lots of people dying. In a population the size of, say, America, the law of averages means that this particular coincidence must happen at least 10 times a day, but it is nonetheless spooky to anyone who experiences it. By the same token, there are light bulbs burning out in street lamps all the time, and a fair few of them must go pop just as someone is passing beneath them. Even so, it still gives the person concerned a nasty turn, especially when the very next street lamp they pass under does exactly the same thing. Kate stood, rooted to the spot. If one coincidence can occur, she told herself, then another coincidence can occur. And if one coincidence happens to occur just after another coincidence, then that is just a coincidence. There was absolutely nothing to feel alarmed about in having a couple of street lamps go pop. She was in a perfectly normal, friendly street, with houses all around her, with their lights on. She looked up at the house next to her, unfortunately, just as the lights in its front window chanced to go out. This was, presumably, because the occupants happened to choose that moment to leave the room. But though it just went to show what a truly extraordinary thing coincidence can be, it did little to improve her state of mind. The rest of the street was still bathed in a dim yellow glow. It was only the few feet immediately around her that were suddenly dark. The next pool of light was just a few footsteps away in front of her. She took a deep breath, pulled herself together, and walked towards it, reaching its very centre at the exact instant that it, too, extinguished itself. The occupants of the two houses she had passed on the way also happened to choose that moment to leave their front rooms, as did their neighbours on the opposite side of the street. Perhaps a popular television show had just finished. That's what it was. Everyone was getting up and turning off their TV sets and lights simultaneously, and the resulting power surge was blowing some of the street lamps, something like that. The resulting power surge was also making her blood pound a little. She moved on, trying to be calm. As soon as she got home, she'd have a look at the paper to see what the program had been that had caused 3 street lamps to blow. 4. She stopped and stood absolutely still under the dark lamp. More houses were darkening. What she found particularly alarming was that they darkened at the very moment she looked at them. Glance, pop. She tried it again. Glance, pop. Each one she looked at darkened instantly. Glance, pop. She realized with a sudden start of fear that she must stop herself looking at the ones that were still lit. The rationalizations she had been trying to construct were now running around inside her head, screaming to be let out, and she let them go. She tried to lock her eyes to the ground for fear of extinguishing the whole street, but she couldn't help tiny glances to see if it was working. Glance, pop. She froze her gaze down onto the narrow path forward. Most of the road was dark now. There were three remaining street lamps between her and the front door which led to her own flat. Though she kept her eyes averted, she thought she could detect on the periphery of her vision that the lights of the flat downstairs from hers were lit. Neil lived there. She couldn't remember his last name, but he was a part-time bass player and antiques dealer who used to give her decorating advice she didn't want and also stole her milk. So her relationship with him had always remained at a slightly frosty level. Just at the moment, though, she was praying that he was there to tell her what was wrong with her sofa, and that his light would not go out as her eyes wavered from the pavement in front of her, with its three remaining pools of light spaced evenly along the way she had to tread. For a moment she tried turning, and looked back the way she had come. All was darkness, shading off into the blackness of the park, which no longer calmed but menaced her, with hideously imagined thick knotted roots and treacherous dark rotting litter. Again she turned, sweeping her eyes low. Three pools of light. The street lights did not extinguish as she looked at them, only as she passed. She squeezed her eyes closed, and visualized exactly where the lamp of the next street light was, above and in front of her. She raised her head, and carefully opened her eyes again, staring directly into the orange glow radiating through the thick glass. It shone steadily. With her eyes locked fast on it, so that it burnt squiggles on her retina, she moved cautiously forward, step by step, exerting her will on it to stay burning as she approached. It continued to glow. She stepped forward again. It continued to glow. Again she stepped. Still it glowed. Now she was almost beneath it, craning her neck to keep it in focus. She moved forward once more, and saw the filament within the glass flicker and quickly die away, leaving an afterimage prancing madly in her eyes. She dropped her eyes now and tried looking steadily forward, but wild shapes were leaping everywhere, and she felt she was losing control. The next lamp she took a lunging run towards, and again sudden darkness enveloped her arrival. She stopped there panting and blinking, trying to calm herself again and get her vision sorted out. Looking towards the last street lamp, she thought she saw a figure standing beneath it. It was a large form, silhouetted with jumping orange shadows. Huge horns stood upon the figure's head. She stared with mad intensity into the billowing darkness, and suddenly screamed at it, "Who are you?" There was a pause, and then a deep answering voice said, "Do you have anything that can get these bits of floorboard off my back?" There was another pause, of a different and slightly disordered quality. It was a long one. It hung there nervously, wondering which direction it was going to get broken from. The darkened street took on a withdrawn, defensive aspect. "What?" Kate screamed back at the figure at last. "I said, what?" The great figure stirred. Kate still could not see him properly, because her eyes were still dancing with blue shadows, seared there by the orange light. "I was," said the figure, "glued to the floor. My father..." "Do you? Are you?" Kate quivered with incoherent rage. "Are you responsible for all this?" She turned and swept an angry hand around the street to indicate the nightmare she had just traversed. "It is important that you know who I am." "Oh, yeah?" said Kate. "Well, let's get the name down right now so that I can take it straight to the police and get you done for breach of something willful or other. Intimidation, interfering with..." "I am Thor. I am the god of thunder, the god of rain, the god of the high towering clouds, the god of lightning, the god of the flowing currents, the god of the particles, the god of the shaping and the binding forces, the god of the wind, the god of the growing crops, the god of the hammer Mjolnir." "Are you?" simmered Kate. "Well, I've no doubt that if you'd picked a slack moment to mention all that, I might have taken an interest. But right now it just makes me very angry. Turn the damn lights on." "I am..." "I said turn the lights on!" With something of a sheepish glow, the street lights all came back on, and the windows of the houses all quietly illuminated themselves once more. The lamp above Kate popped again almost immediately. She gave him a warning look. "It was an old light and infirm," he said. She simply continued to glare at him. "See," he said, "I have your address." He held out the piece of paper she had given him at the airport, as if that somehow explained everything and put the world to rights. "I... back!" he shouted, throwing up his arms in front of his face. What? With a huge rush of wind, a swooping eagle dropped from out of the night sky with its talons outspread to catch at him. Thor beat and thrashed at it until the great bird flailed backwards, turned, nearly crashed to the ground, recovered itself, and with great slow beats of its wings, heaved itself back up through the air and perched on top of the street lamp. It grasped the lamp hard with its talons and steadied itself, making the whole lamppost quiver very slightly in its grip. Go! Shouted Thor at it. The eagle sat there and peered down at him, a monstrous creature made more monstrous by the effect of the orange light on which it perched, casting huge flapping shadows on the nearby houses. It had strange circular markings on its wings. These were markings that Kate wondered if she had seen before, only in a nightmare. But then again, she was by no means certain that she was not in a nightmare now. There was no doubt that she had found the man she was looking for. The same huge form, the same glacial eyes, the same look of arrogant exasperation and slight muddle. Only this time his feet were plunged into huge hide boots, great furs, traps and thongs hung from his shoulders, a huge steel-horned helmet stood on his head, and his exasperation was directed this time not at an airline check-in girl, but at a huge eagle perched on a lamppost in the middle of Primrose Hill. Go! He shouted at it again. The matter is beyond my power. All that I can do, I have done. Your family is provided for. You, I can do nothing more for. I myself am powerless and sick. Kate was suddenly shocked to see that there were great gouges on the big man's left forearm, where the eagle had got its talons into him and ripped them through his skin. Blood was welling up out of them, like bread out of a baking tin. Go! He shouted again. With the edge of one hand, he scraped the blood off his other arm and flung the heavy drops at the eagle, which reared back, flapping, but retained its hold. Suddenly the man leapt high into the air and grappled himself to the top of the lamppost, which now began to shake dangerously under their combined weight. With loud cries, the eagle pecked viciously at him, while he tried with great swings of his free arm to sweep it from its perch. A door opened. It was the front door of Kate's house, and a man with grey-rimmed spectacles and a neat moustache looked out. It was Neil, Kate's downstairs neighbour, in a mood.
"Look, I really think..." he started.
However, it quickly became clear that he simply didn't know what to think, and retreated back indoors, taking his mood unsatisfied with him. The big man braced himself, and with a huge leap, hurled himself through the air and landed with a slight, controlled wobble on top of the next lamppost, which bent slightly under his weight. He crouched, glaring at the eagle, which glared back.
"Go!"
he shouted again, brandishing his arm at it.
"Ah!"
it screeched back at him. With another swing of his arm, he pulled from under his furs a great short-handled sledgehammer and hefted its great weight meaningfully from one hand to another. The head of the hammer was a roughly cast piece of iron, about the size and shape of a pint of beer in a big glass mug, and its shaft was a stocky, wrist-thick piece of ancient oak with leather strapping bound about its handle.
"Gah!"
screeched the eagle again, but regarded the sledgehammer with keen-eyed suspicion. As Thor began slowly to swing the hammer, the eagle shifted its weight tensely from one leg to the other, in time to the rhythm of the swings.
"Go!"
said Thor again, more quietly but with greater menace. He rose to his full height on top of the lamppost, and swung the hammer faster and faster in a great circle. Suddenly he hurled it directly towards the eagle. In the same instant, a bolt of high-voltage electricity erupted from the lamp on which the eagle was sitting, causing it to leap with loud cries wildly into the air. The hammer sailed harmlessly under the lamp, swung up into the air and out over the darkness of the park, while Thor, released to its weight, wobbled and tottered on top of his lamppost, spun round and regained his balance. Flailing madly at the air with its huge wings, the eagle too regained control of itself, flew upwards, made one last diving attack on Thor, which the god leapt backwards off the lamppost to avoid, and then climbed up and away into the night sky, in which it quickly became a small dark speck, and then at last was gone. The hammer came bounding back from out of the sky, scraped flying sparks from the paving stones with its head, turned over once in the air, and then dropped its head back to the ground next to Kate, and rested its shaft gently against her leg. An elderly lady who had been waiting patiently with her dog in the shadows beneath the street lamp which was now defunct, sensed, correctly, that all the excitement was now over, and proceeded quietly past them. Thor waited politely till they had passed, and then approached Kate, who stood with her arms folded watching him. After all the business of the last 2 or 3 minutes, he seemed suddenly not to have the faintest idea what to say, and for the moment merely gazed thoughtfully into the middle distance. Kate formed the distinct impression that thinking was, for him, a separate activity from everything else, a task that needed its own space. It could not easily be combined with other activities, such as walking or talking or buying airline tickets. "We'd better take a look at your arm," she said, and led the way up the steps to her house. He followed, docile. As she opened the front door, she found Neil in the hall, leaning his back against the wall and looking with grim pointedness at a Coca-Cola vending machine standing against the opposite wall and taking up an inordinate amount of space in the hallway.
"I don't know what we're going to do about this, I really don't," he said.
"What's it doing there?" asked Kate.
"Well, that's what I'm asking you, I'm afraid," said Neil. "I don't know how you're going to get it up the stairs. Don't see how it can be done, to be perfectly frank with you. And let's face it, I don't think you're going to like it once you've got it up there. I know it's very modern and American, but think about it. You've got that nice French cherrywood table, that sofa which will be very nice when you've taken off that dreadful Collier Campbell covering, like I keep on saying you should, only you won't listen. And I just don't see how it's going to fit in, not in either sense. And I'm not even sure I should allow it. I mean, it's a very heavy object, and you know what I've said to you about the floors in this house. I'd think again, I really would, you know."
"Yes, Neil. How did it get here?"
"Well, your friend here delivered it just an hour or so ago. I don't know where he's been working out, but I must say I wouldn't mind paying his gym a visit. I said I thought the whole thing was very doubtful, but he would insist, and in the end I even had to give him a hand. But I must say I think we need to have a very serious think about the whole topic. I asked your friend if he liked Wagner, but he didn't respond very well. So I don't know, what do you want to do about it?"
Kate took a deep breath. She suggested to her huge guest that he carry on upstairs, and she would see him in just a moment. Thor lumbered past, and was an absurd figure mounting the stairs. Neil watched Kate's eyes very closely for a clue as to what exactly was going on, but Kate was as blank as she knew how.
"I'm sorry, Neil," she said matter-of-factly.
"The Coke machine will go. It's all a misunderstanding. I'll get this sorted out by tomorrow."
"Yes, that's all very well," said Neil, "but where does all this leave me? I mean, you see my problem."
"No, Neil, I don't."
"Well, I've got this thing out here, you've got that person upstairs, and the whole thing is just a total disruption."
"Is there anything I can do to make anything any better?"
"Well, it's not as easy as that, is it? I mean, I think you should just think about it a bit. That's all. I mean, all this. You told me you were going away. I heard the bath running this afternoon. What was I to think? And after you've gone on about the cat, and you know I won't work with cats."
"I know, Neil. That's why I asked Mrs. Gray next door to look after her."
"Yes, and look what happened to her. Died of a heart attack. Mr. Gray's very upset, you know."
"I don't think it had anything to do with me asking her if she would look after my cat."
"Well, all I can say, he's very upset."
"Yes, Neil, his wife's died."
"Well, I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying I think you should think about it. And what on earth are we going to do about all this?"
he added, readdressing his attention to the Coca-Cola machine.
"I've said that I will make sure it's gone in the morning, Neil," said Kate. "I'm quite happy to stand here and scream very loudly, if you think it'll help in any way, but..."
"Listen, love, I'm only making the point. And I hope you're not going to make a lot of noise up there, because I've got to practice my music tonight. And you know that I need quiet to concentrate." He gave Kate a meaningful look over the top of his glasses, and disappeared into his flat. Kate stood, and silently counted as much of 1 to 10 as she could currently remember, and then headed staunchly up the stairs in the wake of the God of Thunder, feeling that she was not in a mood for either weather or theology. The house began to throb and shake to the sound of the main theme of The Ride of the Valkyries being played on a Fender Precision bass. As Dirk edged his way along the Euston Road, caught in the middle of a rush-hour traffic jam that had started in the late 1970s, and which, at 9:45 on this Thursday evening, still showed no signs of abating, he thought he caught sight of something he recognized. It was his subconscious which told him this, that infuriating part of a person's brain which never responds to interrogation, merely gives little meaningful nudges, and then sits humming quietly to itself, saying nothing. "Well, of course I've just seen something I recognize," Dirk muttered mentally to his subconscious. "I drive along this benighted thoroughfare 20 times a month. I expect I recognize every single matchstick lying in the gutter. Can't you be a little bit more specific?" His subconscious would not be hectored, though, and was dumb. It had nothing further to add. The city was probably full of grey vans anyway, very unremarkable.
"Where?"
Dirk muttered to himself fiercely, twisting round in his seat, this way and that. "Where did I see a grey van?" Nothing. He was thoroughly hemmed in by the traffic, and could not manoeuvre in any direction, least of all forward. He erupted from his car, and started to jostle his way back through the jammed cars, bobbing up and down to try and see where, if anywhere, he might have caught a glimpse of a grey van. If he had seen one, it eluded him now. His subconscious sat and said nothing. The traffic was still not moving, so he tried to thread his way further back, but was obstructed by a large motorcycle courier edging his way forward on a huge, grimy Kawasaki. Dirk engaged in a brief altercation with the courier, but lost it, because the courier was unable to hear Dirk's side of the altercation. Eventually, Dirk retreated through the tide of traffic, which now was beginning slowly to move in all lanes other than the one in which his car sat, driverless, immobile, and hooted at. He felt suddenly elated by the braying of the motor horns, and as he swayed and bobbed his way back through the snarled-up column of cars, he suddenly found that he reminded himself of the crazies he had seen on the streets of New York, who would career out into the road to explain to the oncoming traffic about the Day of Judgment, imminent alien invasions, and incompetence and corruption in the Pentagon. He put his hands above his head and started to shout out, "The gods are walking the earth! The gods are walking the earth!" This further inflamed the feelings of those who were beeping their horns at his stationary car, and quickly the whole rose through a crescendo of majestic cacophony, with Dirk's voice ringing out above it. "The gods are walking the earth! The gods are walking the earth!" he hollered. "The gods are walking the earth! Thank you," he added, and ducked down into his car, put it into drive and pulled away, allowing the whole jammed mass at last to seethe easily forward. He wondered why he was so sure. An act of God. Merely a chance, careless phrase by which people were able to dispose conveniently of awkward phenomena that would admit of no more rational explanation. But it was the chance carelessness of it which particularly appealed to Dirk, because words used carelessly, if they did not matter in any serious way, often allowed otherwise well-guarded truths to seep through. An inexplicable disappearance. Oslo and a hammer. A tiny, tiny coincidence which struck a tiny, tiny note. However, it was a note which sang in the midst of the daily hubbub of white noise, and other tiny notes were singing at the same pitch. An act of God, Oslo, and a hammer. A man with a hammer trying to go to Norway is prevented, loses his temper, and as a result, there is an act of God. If, thought Dirk, if a being were immortal, he would still be alive today. That, quite simply, was what immortal meant. How would an immortal being have a passport? Quite simply, how? Dirk tried to imagine what might happen if, to pick a name quite at random, the god Thor, he of the Norwegian ancestry and the great hammer, were to arrive at the passport office and try to explain who he was and how come he had no birth certificate. There would be no shock, no horror, no loud exclamations of astonishment, just blank bureaucratic impossibility. It wouldn't be a matter of whether anybody believed him or not, it would simply be a question of producing a valid birth certificate. He could stand there wreaking miracles all day if he liked, but at close of business, if he didn't have a valid birth certificate, he would simply be asked to leave. And credit cards. If, to sustain for a moment the same arbitrary hypothesis, the god Thor were alive and for some reason at large in England, then he would probably be the only person in the country who did not receive the constant barrage of invitations to apply for American Express card, crude threats by the same post to take their American Express cards away, and gift catalogues full of sumptuously unpleasant things, lavishly tooled in naff-brown plastic. Dirk found the idea quite breathtaking. That is, if he were the only god at large, which, once you were to accept the first extravagant hypothesis, was hardly likely to be the case. But imagine for a moment such a person attempting to leave the country, armed with no passport, no credit cards, merely the power to throw thunderbolts and who knew what else. You'd probably have to imagine a scene very similar to the one that did in fact occur at Terminal 2 Heathrow. But why, if you were a Norse god, would you be needing to leave the country by means of a scheduled airline? Surely there were other means. Dirk rather thought that one of the perks of being an immortal divine might be the ability to fly under your own power. From what he remembered of his reading of the Norse legends many years ago, the gods were continually flying all over the place. There was never any mention of them hanging around in departure lounges, eating crummy buns. Admittedly, the world was not, in those days, bristling with air traffic controllers, radar, missile warning systems, and the like. Still, a quick hop across the North Sea shouldn't be that much of a problem for a god, particularly if the weather was in your favour, which, if you were the god of thunder, you'd pretty much expect it to be, or want to know the reason why. Should it? Another tiny note sang in the back of Dirk's mind, and then was lost in the hubbub. He wondered for a moment what it was like to be a whale. Physically, he thought, he was probably quite well placed to get some good insights, though whales were better adapted for their lives of gliding about in the vast pelagic blueness than he was for his of struggling up through the Pentonville Road traffic in a weary old Jaguar. But what he was thinking of, in fact, was the whales' songs. In the past, whales had been able to sing to each other across whole oceans, even from one ocean to another, because sound travels such huge distances underwater. But now, again because of the way in which sound travels, There is no part of the ocean that is not constantly jangling with the hubbub of ships' motors, through which it is now virtually impossible for the whales to hear each other's songs or messages. So fucking what is pretty much the way that most people tended to view this problem, and understandably so, thought Dirk. After all, who wants to hear a bunch of fat fish, or right mammals, burping at each other? But, for a moment, Dirk had a sense of infinite loss and sadness, that somewhere amongst the frenzy of information noise that daily rattled the lives of men, he thought he might have heard a few notes that denoted the movements of gods. As he turned north into Islington and began the long haul up past the pizza restaurants and estate agents, he felt almost frantic at the idea of what their lives must now be like. Thin fingers of lightning spread out across the heavy underside of the great clouds which hung from the sky like a sagging stomach. A small crack of fretful thunder nagged at it and dragged from it a few mean drops of greasy drizzle. Beneath the sky ranged a vast assortment of wild turrets, gnarled spires and pinnacles, which prodded at it, goaded and inflamed it, till it seemed it would burst and drown them in a flood of festering horrors. High in the flickering darkness, silent figures stood guard behind long shields. Dragons crouched gaping at the foul sky, as Odin, father of the gods of Asgard, approached the great iron portals which led to his domain and on into the vaulted halls of Valhalla. The air was full of the noiseless howls of great winged dogs, welcoming their master to the seat of his rule. Lightning surged among the towers and turrets. The great, ancient and immortal god of Asgard was returning to the current site of his domain in a manner which would have surprised even him centuries ago in the years of the prime of his life, for even the immortal gods have their primes, when their powers are rampant and they both nourish and hold sway over the world of men, the world whose needs give them birth. He was returning in a large, unmarked, grey Mercedes van. The van drew to a halt in a secluded area. The cab door opened, and there climbed down from it a dull, slow-faced man in an unmarked grey uniform. He was a man who was charged with the work he did in life because he was not one to ask questions, not so much on account of any natural quality of discretion as because he could simply never think of any questions to ask. Moving with a slow, rolling gait, like a paddle being pulled through porridge, he made his way to the rear of the van and opened the rear doors, an elaborate procedure involving the coordinated manipulation of many sliders and levers. At length the door swung open, and if Kate had been present, she might for a moment have been jolted by the thought that perhaps the van was carrying Albanian electricity after all. A haze of light greeted Hillo. The man's name was Hillo. But nothing about this struck him as odd. A haze of light was simply what he expected to see whenever he opened this door. The first time ever he opened it, he had simply thought to himself, "Oh, a haze of light. Oh, well." And more or less left it at that, on the strength of which he had guaranteed himself regular employment for as long as he cared to live. The haze of light subsided and coalesced into the shape of an old, old man in a trolley bed, attended by a short little figure, whom Hillo would probably have thought was the most evil-looking person he had ever seen, if he had had a mind to recall the other people he had seen in his life, and run through them all one by one, making the comparison. That, however, was harder than Hillo wished to work. His only concern at present was to assist the small figure with the decanting of the old man's bed to ground level. This was fluently achieved. The legs and wheels of the bed were a miracle of smoothly operating stainless steel technology. They unlocked, rolled, swiveled, in elaborately interlocked movements, which made the negotiation of steps or bumps all part of the same fluid, gliding motion. To the right of this area lay a large antechamber, panelled in finely carved wood, with great marble torch holders standing proudly from the walls. This in turn led into the great vaulted hall itself. To the left, however, lay the entrance to the majestic inner chambers, where Odin would go to prepare himself for the encounters of the night. He hated all this. Hounded from his bed, he muttered to himself, though in truth he was bringing his bed with him. Made to listen once again to all kinds of self-indulgent claptrap from his boneheaded, thunderous son, who would not accept, could not accept, simply did not have the intelligence to accept, the new realities of life. If he would not accept them, then he must be extinguished. And tonight, Asgard would see the extinction of an immortal god. It was all, thought Odin fractiously, too much for someone at his time of life, which was extremely advanced, but not in any particular direction. He wanted merely to stay in his hospital, which he loved. The arrangement which had brought him to that place was of the sweetest kind, and though it was not without its cost, it was a cost that simply had to be borne, and that was all there was to it. There were new realities, and he had learned to embrace them. Those who did not would simply have to suffer the consequences. Nothing came of nothing, even for a god. After tonight, he could return to his life in the Woodshead Hospital indefinitely, and that would be good. He said as much to Hillo.